Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking derbies as City triumph against United, and we'll be debating who is the best player in the Premier League right now after Pep Guardiola crowned Phil Foden. We'll also be learning about Manchester United's incoming CEO Omar Berada, discussing Mark Clattenburg's comments after Liverpool beat Nottingham Forest, and picking out some of the other biggest moments of the weekend. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got a football reporter who covers both Manchester teams despite being from Yorkshire. It's Paul Hurst. A former footballer who twice scored for Chelsea in two London derbies against Tottenham. It's Tony Cascarino. And another former footballer who made his league debut for Nottingham Forest in a fiery clash against rivals, Derby. Derby, see? Get it?
Good.
See what I did there? Coming on with 5 minutes to go and still managing to get booked. Gregor Robertson is here as well. Quite a debut then. League debut. You come steaming on and just fly into a tackle.
I got booked before I touched the ball. Yeah. I think there was like a looping ball in the air. I think it was Pescasolo though. Nipped in front of me like it was spinning in the air. And I tried to volley it clear, and he's one of them where he's poked it, and I just volleyed Pescasolo instead.
So you might have got a red in this day and age.
I came on because there was a red.
Yeah, you were down to 10 men. They threw you on to keep the point.
It felt like longer than 5 minutes, too. Definitely felt like a lot longer than
that. I should also say, being generous here, the soccer base website, it's got you as coming on at 88.
Yeah, there must have been a lot of added time. A lot of injury time.
Yeah. And Kaz, I mean, I would say that as well, when it comes to research on your career, just that slight couple of years that you've got on Gregor makes it a little bit more difficult. So I'm sure you're more successful in derbies than the ones I picked out.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure where you stood with the facts or your research. You obviously, your Googleizing, whatever you're doing, is way off, by the way. You've missed a few London derbies.
Go on then.
I scored against West Ham. I scored a hat-trick in the Makita as well against Tottenham, if anyone remembers the Makita tournament, which was quite a funny day for me, getting a hat-trick for Chelsea.
What was the Makita?
It was a pre-season tournament. It was a four-robin team. I can't remember all of the teams in it, but you can Google and watch my hat-trick if you want.
Yeah.
But I also scored against QPR. Home and away.
Very good.
There are others in there.
I've given you the platform to mention it.
You literally
didn't score against Arsenal, though.
No, never scored against Arsenal.
Never mind. And anyway, Hursty, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
As Gregor has already alluded to before we started recording, my northern accent has gone up a couple of notches because I've spent the morning chatting to you before we came on the show. So by the end of it, I'll be saying e-bye gump and all sorts. But to Manchester then. And another one-sided Manchester derby. Hursty, you were there and you've written a piece for us, which I'd say is quite a balanced piece, and it's a difficult one. We've referenced your tough task as the Manchester man having to cover these games. How do you compliment City and how do you be critical and constructive about Manchester United? This is about where they're at, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to get across in the article. Not sure whether I did it or not, but it was like, that was their level. That's United's level, I think, now. They're so far below City in terms of the quality of the squad, in terms of the quality of players, the depth of the squad, the management of the players as well, I would argue. You were never going to get United turning up and trying to pass through a midfield of Rodri, Kevin De Bruyne and Bernardo Silva. It just wasn't going to happen. So they went long ball, and it worked for them to start off with. Watching that game, you thought City always, they're going to score here. They're going to score at least one. They're going to end up winning it. So I thought it was almost like an exercise in damage limitation for Man United. But if you were a United fan before that game, you'd have probably taken a 3-1 defeat, which says a lot about where they're at the moment, isn't it?
In terms of fans, you talk about that. That was a question I was going to ask, but you brought it up. What's the atmosphere like for these games, both home and away? Because they're fascinating. We were talking on Thursday's show about the kind of categories that these games fall into.
Yeah.
Either a smash and grab, a nil-nil, or a City 85% possession job. Yeah. Is the atmosphere of a derby? You know, we've mentioned some great derbies already, but is it of a derby, or is it of this slight understanding that this is how it's going to go?
I think everyone knew the script or knew that was how it was going to end up. But certainly first 5 minutes, it was quiet from both sides. I think everyone was just sort of taking it in. And then when United scored, their fans really got behind them and thinking, you know, is this actually going to happen? And they actually had another chance, didn't they, with Rashford after he'd scored. So they were getting really kind of confident about it. But yeah, as soon as Foden scored that equaliser, I think that was a turning point, wasn't it? I just think everyone knew that he was going to end up in a City victory from then.
Tony, what did you make of the game?
Well, what did I say to you on Thursday?
What did you tell me?
No, we talked. I said it was there's no contest.
Yeah.
There's no contest. And even the fact that United got a wonder goal, because it was a wonder goal, it sort of started there. There was a couple of incidents where Rashford broke through, went to ground too easily. Mm. And I immediately thought, as soon as that happened, I remember thinking, why are you going to ground when you're in a great position? Did you choose to go to ground, or did you try and stay on your feet?
Mm.
And the Aguero goal struck me was when he got that late goal that won him the title, where he could have gone to ground on that goal. I remember thinking, he stood up. Every centre forward at that time was going down, and he's gone, I'm staying on my feet and I'm going to score this. And Rashford had two chances like that in the game. And I'm not picking on him, because it wasn't about that. The pause in his piece is absolutely spot on. That, you know, you're sort of applauding United for losing 3-1 in a way. I couldn't see a way that they could win the game. I said, if I've been doing punditry 20-odd years, I can't make one argument that United can go and win at City. Maybe if a goalkeeper was extraordinary. Maybe if the VAR had taken its place and made an ultimate decision. But if you're talking about what you've witnessed over the last 9 months, 5 years, whatever, you're looking at two completely different... This is Muhammad Ali against Audley Harrison in boxing.
Yeah,
It's like what we said on Thursday, though. You kind of... We were like... You know, you wonder if it's going to be one of those ones where it's really humbling and it sort of like emphasises the chasm and the gulf and like embarrassing almost. But it wasn't embarrassing for Manchester United. It's almost the embarrassment stems from like there was the gulf, but it was just like, yeah, that's kind of, you know, accepted now.
That's
really what it was, the thing that must be hard to take for Manchester United fans.
Going back to your point, Tony, about Rashford going to ground, I said that to Charlotte Dunker, a colleague who was sat next to me, said he's done that on purpose. You know, he's gone to ground on purpose.
Yeah.
He's looking to buy a free kick when he's pretty much through on goal.
Yeah.
I know we all know that Walker is, you know, he's rapid, isn't he? But if Rashford had that self-belief that he's had in himself in previous years, certainly last year, he wouldn't have thought anything about it. He would have been handing him off, and he would have tried to go through and score.
Second half as well, Paul, there was the incident as well out wide when he got half a yard and he's chose to go to ground. And I remember thinking straight away the Aguero goal struck me as thinking, that guy stayed, and why did he get so many goals? Because one thing you could say, Aguero stayed on his feet.
Mm.
You know, and it's unfair because it's not about Marcus Rashford and Sergio Aguero. It just struck me, that incident in the match. And look, Paul's been Manchester and been the correspondent for a year. And it's like deja vu. It's Groundhog Day.
Mm.
I just don't know what I could say that everybody else has already said.
It's like the conflict between what Manchester United think they should be and what they are. So it's like, you know, you point out in your piece, this is the way they should have set up because of the level of their players, because of...
A lot of injuries as well, let's be honest.
Yeah, although really, there were probably three that were like important players.
Three big
ones. And still,
Shaw and Martinez are big.
Still, you'd think that the balance...
Absolutely. Really, I'm not suggesting that they would have given it a 4-3 win if they'd have had Shaw and Martinez.
But that's the conflict. And then there's still always a little nagging feeling that should Ten Hag still be kind of, despite all of that, making Manchester United trying to bring his vision of what he really wants them to be like to life, would another manager, really another elite manager, play this way? Would Roberto De Zerbi play this way? Would someone like, you know, would any of the kind of real up and coming coaches, would they have this level of pragmatism? I'm not saying one's right or wrong, but that's also a little thing that's going to be a major kind of issue for Ten Hag in the next few months, because we're not seeing any evidence of what he wants them to be.
Yeah, I would add that if you watch City, probably as we all have for the last 5-7 years, that they very hardly ever get a beating. No one's ever took them. Liverpool beat them 4-1 at Anfield.
Yeah.
But one game that struck me this season was Villa at Villa Park. They lost 1-0. They took a real pounding off Villa.
Mm.
Now, you'd like to think Man United could sort of put up a bit more of a fist, make of a fist of the game. And we all go, well, you can't get the ball off them. And yes, they're going to dominate possession. It was probably the most predictable game of the season for me, where you say, well, you know they're going to have way more shots than Ertis Peace, 27, you know, shot counts of 3. You knew that they'd hog the ball for 70%+. All this was very, very predictable. The only thing I would think that Ten Hag is manager of Manchester United, and it reminds me of when I worked for 5 years doing Eredivisie football. You had PSV, you had Feyenoord, and you had Ajax. They all played an aggressive way. But everybody below that would just try and hang in a game. And United remind me of an Eredivisie mid-table team.
Mm. Interesting. Talking about Ten Hag, Paul, in your piece you referenced some of the quotes and the kind of pragmatism and the realism that which he talks about the team at the minute.
Yeah.
Does he feel like a man frustrated by that?
Yeah, certainly when it comes to the injuries, you know, he's been scratching his head all season about that, you know, and they actually did an audit of, you know, the players that were injured, tried to look into everything from nutrition to sleep patterns to the beds they were sleeping on, pillows, everything, you know, yeah. that kind of like level of detail. But, you know, you guys will know better than me, but you wonder, like, with all these injuries that they're getting, muscle injuries in particular, whether he's like overworking them, because especially this time of the season when they're playing once a week, they're playing Saturday and, you know, and the following Saturday. So I generally don't know if that's the answer, but you thought that situation would be easing now, but if anything, it's getting worse. You know, Shaw's out for the season. You know, Maguire's missed the last couple as well. So, yeah, I mean, that in terms of injuries, yeah, it is a real source of frustration for him.
In terms of his demeanour otherwise, in terms of the pressure of being Manchester United manager, tell us a bit, mate, about that kind of his demeanour in press conferences generally over the last year and a half.
Yeah,
has it changed, or is he always a certain way?
I do feel sorry for him. Well, I feel sorry for him is the wrong way of putting it, because he's Man United manager. This is part of his job. You know, he has to speak to people like, unfortunately, speak to people like me every week, you know, more than, you know, twice, three times a week. But he's, I always think of this situation, what's he going to say? Is he really going to say, yeah, we are miles apart from Man City and we were lucky to get away with 3-1 today? He's not going to say that, is he? So what kind of message would that send to his players if he said that? The problem I think that he will have in the back of his mind, and it, touching on what you were saying, Gregory, earlier, is that you've got the new owner of Man United, person who was in charge of the football operations at Man United, saying that Manchester City beating Real Madrid was the best football he's ever seen, like last year. And that is better than best. It's better than, you know, Cantona and Giggs and Scholes, etc. And then you then watch your team in a derby defend and defend and defend and defend. And you think that is such a big gap between what we saw on the pitch yesterday and what Jim Ratcliffe's vision is for the club moving forward. Mm. So if you're Ten Hag thinking, right, well, he wants that, but I can't deliver it with the players that I've got here now, certainly not with the injuries that I've injury list that I've got. And then, you know, part of you from the outside, people outside thinking, like you say, Gregor, should he not be getting more out of them as well? You know, could they at least not have a little go at trying to play some, you know, more attractive football? Not against City, because, you know, they batter them, but in quite a lot of other games this season, we've just seen it's been quite pedestrian football, really. It's not. I've rarely seen any kind of. They played better last year. They played better football last year.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. I was interested in that, like, trajectory, if you like, because when he came in, there was lots of desires to play out from the back and things, and struggles with David De Gea and things. And then he kind of, I remember discussing with you a press conference, maybe it was this early in this season, where you talked about having the players that I've got, yeah. I can't... Was it referring to playing a bit more long ball and a bit more direct? I have to play direct.
Yeah.
Do you get the sense that it is the pragmatism thing and that he is kind of, listen, this is what I've got? Does he want to play a different way? Does he want to play that Jim Ratcliffe way?
I think he does, but then, you know, you look at the people that he brought in the summer. You know, Onana was the guy who was supposed to not fix that, but certainly be a big part of the resolution of that problem. Because looking back to that FA Cup semi-final against Brighton last year, I mean, that was the most boring games I've ever been to. That, you know, he was literally your neck was hurting because they were just lumping it all the time. De Gea was pumping it up to Martial and Rashford. They weren't winning headers. But because he didn't trust him to pass it out from the back, then, you know, that was the only thing that they could do. He was being pragmatic then. Mm. But, like, he brought in a goalkeeper who was, you referred to in that UEFA technical report, as playing like a defensive midfielder, like a ball player, a playmaker almost. Mm. So, and he's actually, you know, Onana had quite a good game yesterday, I thought.
I was going to say,
And in terms of his distribution, he's a lot better than De Gea. So, I tell you, the building blocks are sort of there for them to play better, more progressive football than the last season. But for whatever reason, it's just not happened.
Gregor, what do you make of that idea about that trajectory of pattern in United's play? Do you understand that pragmatism that he's showing? Do you kind of see any seeds of potential with the likes of Onana and others, maybe when Shaw and Martinez are playing?
Yeah, I just think for his future, he has to demonstrate that. Now, really.
Yeah.
Has to demonstrate a style, you mean?
Yeah, we have to see some of that, or else I don't think he'd be the manager. Like, you think back to even Mikel Arteta's sort of journey with Arsenal, and, like, there, you know, we saw how he wanted them to play, and then there was a bit of a sort of a streak of pragmatism entered the play. I think they went to three at the back, and they sort of, you know, they were set up more defensively. But then the thing is, when they start to spend money and they got the recruitment right, you know, there's a better sort of, felt like there was a better structure and organisation around them. Although, you know, we took some convincing about that as well. But it's turned out that the recruitment has been greatly improved. So he was able to start taking steps and then eventually bring what he wants, you know, the way he wants Arsenal to play to life. I do have some sympathy, as you're alluding to, like, I do have some sympathy with Ten Hag, because it's almost like all the responsibility has been freighted on him, because, you know, signed Antony and a lot of players who were, you know, and Anna as well, a lot of players who were clearly had his fingerprints all over them. So when they've not been a success, it's just another stick to beat him with. So, but fundamentally, I come back to it, it's like, it's almost the same discussion we have about David Moyes at West Ham. He has, if he wants to be the long-term manager, you have to show progression. You have to show a sort of step change in what the offering is. What the vision for the team is going to be, and we're not seeing that.
Yeah.
Just on one thing, again, that has really struck me is that press conferences after matches, and we all agree, you lose matches, the words get lost. Whatever you say is not going to make anyone feel any better. You're going to get hammered by, whether it's media, by radio, you're going to get stick, TV, it's going to happen. But also his view of games strikes me as being a bit, well, that's not a game I watched.
Hmm.
You know, his view seems to be a bit, I think you have to be honest to a certain degree. You know, you can't say, well, we played well and we you know, you can't. And some of his interviews after games have struck me as being,
even if he's trying to defend the players, keep not let confidence take a battering if you were in that dressing room.
I'm sorry. Honestly, Tom, I'm sorry. If your confidence suffers and you're at Man United, then you're at the wrong club.
Hmm.
You know, it's a huge club. It's like saying you go to Real Madrid and you're suffering for confidence. You're doing it at Real Madrid. Mm. You know, you have to have a swagger about you. You have to have an air of confidence. That's a given for me. I was lucky. I probably played with, I think, about 8 United players, all different types, from Kevin Moran, Paul McGrath, Sheringham, Keane, Irwin, and others. There's about 8 of them. And they all had something in them that made them a Man United player. Whether it was character, whether it was tenacity, whether it was technical, they all had it. Kevin Moran wasn't the most gifted, But boy, could he defend. He had a heart the size of a lion. Mm. You know, he was a relentless centre-half who just challenged everything. McGrath, at his very best, was one of the best centre-halves I've ever seen. Well, definitely played with. And then you go through, and I don't have to mention Irwin and whatever, but they all had huge qualities to be a Man United player. I honestly, a lot of these players haven't got the qualities. They're all lacking something in there. And I don't want it to become a... I've played at United twice, lost 4-0, 5-1.
Right.
And I remember coming off and thinking, it's impossible. Mm. You can't out-battle them. You can't outplay them. You can't out, technical, just anything in the game. You couldn't do any of that to them. Mm. It was basically a tin hat job against a very gifted side.
Yeah.
And that was, ultimately, I don't see that.
Yeah.
You don't need a tin hat. Then you don't even need an hat to play this Man United team.
Final thought.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And what is it, 11 games they've lost this season in the league? Is that right?
Mm-hmm. I'm about right, yeah.
Check the BBC website.
It's the worst they've had in the season is 12. It's
correct,
yeah,
11.
I always think, and you're right, and about the Old Trafford, particularly Old Trafford, I think, the amount of games that they lost this season, like last weekend, Fulham, poor away record. The way that they set up, the way that they played, it was as if they expected to win. And that Brighton game early on the season, I don't think anyone was really surprised that they beat them.
No.
And it's just this thing that kind of...
We saw it in the only game of the season, Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
Wolves, they lost the game.
Onana, wiping out one of their players. It was, somehow didn't get punished for it. You're right, that aura about United... Has been sort of chilled away for the last, 10, 11 years, hasn't it? Mm. To the point now where, again, wrote this morning, that is their level at the moment. That is their, they're a fifth and a sixth, fourth, fifth, sixth team, might squeeze into Champions League once in a while. And quite a lot of that is because of the lack of self-belief and the lack of aura and the lack of, kind of,
swagger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you go to United, and the guy who announces them on the pitch says, "Oh, well, the greatest home of the greatest club in the world." It's like, no, you're not. You look at, you've not won the league. Since Fergie retired, you're a sort of second tier at best club in the Premier League. That's their level at the moment, and a lot of that is down to, like I say, lack of character, lack of belief. You talk to people who've kind of know, like, in and around the dressing room, and you just think that they've just not got that kind of belief in themselves that they can actually go and do, I know they've been on a decent run recently, but not like go 10, 12, 14, that kind of run and blow teams away. They just haven't got that about them, and that's why they're so vulnerable.
Missing that swagger. Well, speaking of swagger, let's talk about Manchester City. And very quickly, Tony, I want your verdict on the Erling Haaland miss. Miss of the season, miss of the century, or just actually quite a difficult chance taking it halfway up the air in a karate kick fashion?
Tom, are you expecting me to criticise the striker? He's got the most unbelievable record.
I'm not expecting you to criticise him at all. I'm expecting you to give us a striker's verdict on that chance.
I think he's got caught in two minds.
Yeah.
And it's sort of in the midriff area, isn't it? And sometimes you think afterwards, I should have headed it.
Yeah.
Just throw myself at it and head it.
Don't worry. We don't need endless debate on that. I just wanted a one-liner from you. That's all. I just thought we'd move on. Phil Foden, though, I want more than one line on this. The best player in the Premier League right now, according to Pep Guardiola. Some fascinating comments for a player that he's often not quite critical of, but has an interesting relationship with, doesn't he, Hirsty?
Yeah, and it was, when I saw that quote, I was very, very surprised by it, just for that reason, because it's not always been plain sailing between those two. And I don't mean that they've been, at each other like loggerheads. I just mean that that Pep, as part of his philosophy, is don't sort of build the ego, keep him grounded. And he always says when
he's... Felt like he's done that specifically a lot with Foden, though.
Yeah, and I think that's because of the... it's partly because of us, the expectations that we sort of put on the player, because he's generational talent, isn't he? So whenever someone in the past has praised Foden, he said, oh yeah, well, he doesn't, there's still parts he needs to improve, he needs to talk about, Pep talks about him when he, because Foden wants to play in the middle, and he wants to play as number 10, but Guardiola always talks about how he's not he needs to be aware of what's going on behind him. He needs to have like a full perception of what's going on around him. And he says the only player that they've got who does that at the moment is Rodri. And he's not on that kind of level. So there's always been, with a compliment, it's always felt a bit backhanded. He's always like picked like holes in his games as well. But yesterday when he was, when he came off, he was given like, sort of did a lap of honour around the pitch. And when he came round to the dugout, Pep, you know, usually he's a very tactile guy, Pep, isn't he? But this time it was like, you know, massive high five and big hug and this thing. That he now, I think he's fully believes in everything that he does, and that's why he called him the best yesterday.
Yeah, it's that reward almost, isn't it, for that kind of tough love? And yeah, he's like, see, you stuck with me. You didn't throw your toys out of the pram. You stuck with me.
It's almost Mourinho-esque. Mourinho did it with Shaw for. I mean, he went overboard with Luke Shaw. Maybe that's not a. But you know, he's not on that level. But it was almost like, you know, you think you made it, but you know, I've coached. You know, he always means, oh, I've coached Messi. You know, that kind of. Yeah. He always said that you're not on that level. You're not on that level, and it's that must be really frustrating if you're Foden. You just think, oh, I'm pretty good. So that's probably driven him. And I remember, you know, when Foden was coming through, and again, it was partly our fault. The clamour for him to, you know, why aren't you playing him more? Why don't you loan him out to Leeds? And we all just like, he was like, yeah, just chill out. You know, yeah. I've got this. Yeah. You know, I know his career path, and I know his plan, and it's exactly what they do at Barcelona. Unless you are an absolutely exceptional talent, you know, someone like Messi, you will not get guaranteed first team football, or certainly in the more illustrious years of Barcelona, until you are 20, 21, 22, not when you're 16, 17, 18. You know, that is when you're learning about the game. Well, you guys will know more than me, but those are your kind of formative years, aren't you? They're not, you're not ready for it then, I don't think. So Pep's always had that plan to sort of integrate him and sort of for him to be started hitting his peak or sort of pushing towards his peak now, and, you know, it's paid off, and you know, so it's
very nice of you to say know how they feel. Gregor might be left footed, but it's a big sliding scale from Messi to Foden to Gregor Robertson. But anyway, we're talking, let's get into the debate then. Who is the best player in the Premier League currently? Are we all agreeing with Pep Guardiola that it's Phil Foden? Tony Cascarino, why don't you go first?
No, I'm staying where I've been for quite a number of weeks, in Ollie Watkins.
Ollie Watkins,
I think he's had an incredible season. That I can't think of any player that's had such an impact on a team. Not only with goals, with assists, but his performances. I looked a couple of weeks ago over. I wiped down a team of the week, as you know, every weekend, and kept seeing Ollie Watkins and kept thinking, well, I can't drop him and leave him out just because someone might say, well, why have you got Watkins in every week?
Bit of tough love, like Pep Guardiola. Yeah. He's looking at it going, Tony's left me out of his bastard team of the week.
But you know what I mean? It's like, this weekend, I was like, Ollie Watkins has got two again. Oh, no. He was brilliant in the first half against Luton. I mean, can't leave him out. He's been the best centre forward this weekend. So I'm going to stay with Watkins because I just think he's had an amazing season.
Good shout. Hirsty, are you going with Foden?
Yeah, I am, yeah. I just think, obviously, I've watched Man City more than United more than anyone else, but that this season he's taken that responsibility to a new level. You know, they've no De Bruyne in that team for 4 or 5 months. And he was the most creative player in that team, and for him to do that to fill such a big hole as he has done, I think he's at the moment he's certainly the best kind of attacking player in the Premier League.
Where do you think his best position is? Coming back to that point you made about playing as a 10 and Guardiola playing him out wide, and obviously being on that right hand side, which allows him to score that great goal cutting in on his left foot.
Yeah,
although he did the same when on the left hand side.
Exactly,
little combination.
Yeah, I still think he's at his best on the wing where he's got a bit more space.
Yeah,
and he
can isolate players.
With a bit of license,
yeah, and then but he obviously thinks that he should be number 10, and that's where, to be fair, like when he was coming through, he was playing the youth team, he always played there. And when he got into the first team, he'd sort of like mirror David Silva or the way that he played. So he's always had it in his mind that was his, you know, that his destiny to be the number 10. But I think he's getting him closer to goal with less responsibility and having more space. That is just, it's just like a great cocktail for him, isn't it?
I just want to ask you one question on that. How about his energy of running? It's just extraordinary.
Yeah. One of my colleagues yesterday, or one of, from another paper, not ours, said like, was gobsmacked when they were watching Foden run back. I can't remember, I think it was the second half. And he's like, oh, Foden's quick. I was like, yeah, he's rapid. You know, it's just like, and it, but he's not just going forward, he's tracking back as well. And he's, people don't really appreciate this, but he's an absolute Trojan of a workhorse. You know, off the ball, he'll be scrapping, you know, just as much as, you know, Alvarez is and De Bruyne and Rodri. He's all over the place. And I was watching one of the post-match interviews and he just looks, you know, delighted but drained. He's left absolutely everything out there. Mm. So he gives, you know, a lot more off the ball than people think. And, and that pace, it works as good in defence as it does in attack.
Gregor?
I'm going for Rodri.
I thought you were going to say John McGinn. Go on.
No, look, I mean, I think it's instructive. Look, Foden's one of the easiest on the eyes now. And it, like, these debates are always like tilted by that. But I'd say the player who's most important for his team, the player who's most effective player in the league, player who's now gone unbeaten 59 games in all competitions, and the player who Manchester City looked, if not bereft, like in some a bit of hot water without, was Rodri. Mm. I think they could more easily find an alternative to Phil Foden than they can to Rodri. I think he's almost unique in the Premier League this season.
Well, speaking of Rodri, I'm going to give an honourable mention to Declan Rice, but my vote would go to Bukayo Saka, who I think, similar to kind of Foden, in a different way, more intensity, more pressure put on him, I think, for Arsenal, but went through a little dip, maybe few injury worries, but at the minute, in the last couple of weeks, I've watched him and thought, you are very, very close, if not already there, at the kind of world-class Champions League level type player. And he's doing that kind of talisman type performance, I think, for Arsenal. We'd spent a lot of the first half of the season talking about, oh, they need a striker and stuff. All of a sudden, Saka's just scoring. And he's got that kind of Mo Salah about him now, where Saka's going to score. It'll be the same thing. Underrated players, using the best player in the league as a jump-off. I always think it's nice to give a little nod to some underrated players. Tony?
I'd say one I did think of is the boy at Bournemouth, Semenyo. You know, I just think he's got 6 Premier League goals this year. And Bournemouth had a good season. And I just thought, no one really mentions him, but he's really quick and direct, isn't he? And he gets on the ball and he's caught. I think he's a player that's going to be getting a lot better in the next year or two. And I don't hear much talk about him. Mm. But I think there's been a few eyebrows raised about his performances because he's been really good this year.
Gregor? So who John McGinn?
That's obvious. He's not underrated anymore. Anyway. I think Pascal Gross. Still. I know he kind of is someone who
he's... He's everyone's favourite underrated player, I'd say.
But it continues. Who are the three players who've got double figures for assists?
Hmm.
Watkins is one. Kieran Trippi. And Pascal Gross.
Very good.
He's also got 4 goals. Like, he's always, every season...
Good stats to back up your answers as well. Not like the rest of us just waffling along.
He's going to go for Veltman for a moment. Joel Veltman.
No, every season he's one of the most creative players, and De Zerbi is like, you know, waxes lyrical about him all the time. Like, he can play right back and then end up as an auxiliary number 10. He can play centre mid. He can start in a number 10. He can play wide. He's just a complete footballer. He's brilliant.
Well, you've left your defenders union behind, so I'm going to have to mention some defenders. I'd give Gabriel at Arsenal, I'd say, a little underrated, as much as Saliba gets a lot of the attention and praise. Gabriel is someone that I've criticised on this podcast before for slightly losing his head in big games, but he's shown this season, I think, a growth into that big game player that maybe Arsenal are showing as well. And picking out another Brighton player, Lewis Dunk, I think is massively underrated. True. I think should definitely be part of the conversation for England for the Euros.
So you've gone for three then?
No, only two. Gabriel and Lewis Dunk. Oh, only two. God. Listen, Tony, I'm here to make sure that everyone gets a fair shout. You know, you guys can pick all the headline names. I'm just making sure everyone gets a fair shout. Hirsty finishes off with an underrated player.
Well, I was going to go for Rodri, to be fair, as my underrated.
Underrated?
Player. Well, you know, like in terms of like the role that he does for the job.
So good, he's actually underrated.
But, like, you know, in terms of his role that he does for the team, that is. Is, as Gregory said, the most important cog in that team.
Yeah.
And you take him out when he got sent off against, Forest he got sent off, or Wolves, I can't remember. And he was suspended for the Arsenal match, and they brought Kovacic in, and Kovacic just lost his head, you know. And without that composure, without that person controlling that midfield, they're just not the same team at all. So
heard it here first. Rodri's so good, he's underrated.
Don't tell anyone else that. It's under the radar.
Absolutely. Keep that one to yourself. Manchester United fans, we're going to finish with a bit of positivity for you, despite that defeat in the derby, because we're going to talk about your incoming CEO, Omar Berada, and the piece that Hurst, you wrote at the weekend, a big profile of the man who's kind of been Manchester City's transfer guru. Tell us a bit more about him from that piece.
Well, he's been a... Everyone looks at Man City and thinks that Cheeky Begiristan is he's the director of football, so he does all the signings. But basically, last four years in particular, he and Omar Berada have worked as like a double act. You know, Cheeky Begiristan's gone and, you know, identified the players along with Pep and kind of done the technical side of it. But the bones of the nuts and bolts of the deal have all been done by Omar Berada. And that's why it was him and Begiristan. They flew to Monaco, I think it was February this year, 2022, to get the Haaland deal done. And, you know, they were the two most important people for that deal. And he's, United... Speaking to people who are involved in the club now, they look at the structure of the club and just think it's just all over the place at the moment. And the way that they work with Nice, I think they was a bit of a sort of a scalding experience for them. They sort of went down, I think, like sort of Galactico or Real Deal, or certainly bringing in high profile players, thinking that would work, and it didn't. So they set up a structure where they had a director of football, performance director, technical director, CEO, and they basically want to do that with United now, but they want every one of those positions to be filled by someone who is, as Jim Ratcliffe said the other day, 10 out of 10. You know, that is, if they're going to knock City off their perch in 3 or 4 years, they think that is how they're going to do it. Certainly that will be the first step, that how they're going to do it. So they want, you know, the elite people in these roles. And Berada is very, very intelligent guy. He worked at Barcelona as their head of sponsorship for a few years. He was in charge of sponsorship at City as well for a while. And he's got a lot of connections within the... he's a very good networker. And he knows a lot of people in football, and he's very good at doing these deals, like I said. So when Dave Brailsford and Jean-Claude Blanc started looking at the Ineos executives, started looking at filling these positions, Berada was the only one that they had for the CEO. He was the only one that they spoke to. The Glazers, Joel and Avram Glazer came over after they had identified him, interviewed him, and pretty quickly they got the deal done. And City always thought that Berada would end up in a senior role somewhere else, or he'd be poached by NFL or MLS or Major League Baseball, because he spent part of his childhood in America, and he's got a very broad understanding and interest in other sports as well. And interesting, that's part of the reason why he was attracted to United, because he gets to work with Brailsford, who's, you know, obviously worked in cycling, and he's excelled at that. And then they've started looking at different sports as well with Ineos. So They think this is the start of, or that's how they start the, you know, the fight back, by bringing these, you know, elite people at the top of their positions, and then hopefully the rest will, take care of itself, because that sounds easy, doesn't it? But we'll sort of filter down, and then you end up getting the results of that off the pitch.
You talk about the deals that he's done. He's also made a name for himself for the deals that he hasn't done as well at City, in terms of ones that he's maybe turned down and let go.
Yeah.
In terms of being that tough negotiator.
Yeah, the one thing that he was always... People at City always say he's got, like, you know, he's very big on budget responsibility and, you know, handle on the budget. So he knows when to pull out of a deal. He's got red lines. He knows realistically where those are. That he won't go over the pay over the odds for players. So when Pep was in... when he wanted Harry Maguire... in 2019, and they were at Leicester asking for 80-85 million, he said no, and Pep, you know, had to agree with that. You know, him and Begiristan had said, look, that's ridiculous money, and, you know, obviously looking back on it, it
good
was
call. Yeah.
and even going back to the Alexis Sanchez deal, he was seen as a potential game changer for City, to someone who'd, you know, drive him to winning the Champions League. United gazumped them in that transfer, but they paid a ridiculous amount in terms of wages. So I think, you know, Berardi and Begiristan looked at that and said, do we really want to be paying, you know, 400 grand a week to this 29-year-old Chilean? You know, he was having a bad season at Arsenal at that point as well. So that is, from speaking to people who know him and have worked with him, that is one of the most impressive aspects of his how he goes about his business, that he knows when to come out of a deal, knows when it's not good value for money. And how many times have you mentioned Anthony earlier?
Yeah,
the red line should have been at, what, 40 million?
Yeah.
30 million? Not 85 million.
15 million, 10 million?
No, well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Even sorry, less
I'm
now.
Being,
yeah.
I'm being mischievous. But no, it's an absolutely fascinating piece. And if you search the interweb for Paul Hurst and Omar Berardi, you will find it and be directed to the Times website to read it. And if you've got any views on who the best player in the Premier League is or who the most underrated players are, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But for now, stick with us. We're going to be talking about Mark Clattenburg next.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Paul Hurst, Tony Cascarino, and Gregor Robertson. And Gregor Robertson, it's where you were at the weekend, and your piece on the Times website now that I'm going to start section two with. I'm going to read a bit to you. So I thought it was a lovely intro.
Okay.
How on earth did we get here to the bizarre, unedifying spectacle that unfolded on Saturday at the City Ground, where a former Premier League official, who is now a club consultant and also moonlighting as a referee on the BBC's reboot of Gladiators, was fielding questions from reporters about the performance of one of his former colleagues? You're talking about Mark Clattenburg, of course. After the game between Nottingham Forest and Liverpool and Paul Turney's error in that match, tell us more about the scenario that you're depicting there and how it unfolded after that match.
Not the scenario on the pitch, the scenario afterwards.
We'll come back to the scenario on the pitch afterwards. Set the scene for us.
Yeah, you're in the mix zone afterwards, and it quickly became clear that Mark Clattenburg was going to make an appearance. Mark Clattenburg obviously has been was appointed, I think, about a fortnight ago as a referee analyst, some advisory role anyway, by Forrest, because Forrest feels so aggrieved by the number of decisions they perceive have gone against them this season. Clattenburg came out and he answered a few questions for BBC Radio 5 Live, and then he started to field questions from reporters. And a few people tried to ask a question, and his first thing he said was, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, one question at a time, please." And you just got the impression that he was really quite enjoying the position that he was holding as this mouthpiece for Nottingham Forest. I just found it all quite remarkable, really. And that's being polite, like that he came very close to justifying or sort of excusing the actions of his new employer, Evangelos Marinakis, who, you know, as we saw, stood glowering on the touchline at the referee, Paul Tierney, after the match, then walked down the tunnel, and then it later became clear that he had a bit of a... he had a few things to say to Tierney in the tunnel anyway. I think some of the initial stories were blown out of proportion a little bit. He said he chased him down the tunnel and stuff. He didn't do that, but he did shout some things at him and tried to speak to him afterwards and had a bit of an exchange. And he's got previous for this too. He was banned in Greece for doing this. He's all sorts of complaints about officials in Greece as well, as where he owns Olympiakos. And as Tony put it in his column today, it's just kind of smacks of a very rich man who thinks he should be getting what he wants. And this is employing Mark Clattenburg was another step towards what he thinks is doing that.
Because that's bizarre as well, isn't it? That is absolutely bonkers that a football club are employing a former referee as a kind of consultancy role.
Yeah, I mean, looking into it a bit, it's a bit more commonplace in Europe. It's not that common, but Real Madrid, for example, a club who have had, you know, their own issues with officialdom, to put it politely, have employed somebody for 15 years. But even when you hear what his role is, it just all feels really sleazy and cozy relationships. Like, he welcomes the match day officials and takes them to the dressing room.
This is Clattenburg, to be clear, not
no, this is the Real Madrid guy. But Clattenburg's been hired to do the same. Let's not make any bones about it. He's the guy who lobbies federations or the PGMOL. He said afterwards, I'll be using my relationships at the PGMOL to get in contact and to see what the right course of action is next. He said he tried to go in and see Paul Tierney. How did he feel emboldened enough to go and knock on Paul Tierney's dressing room door afterwards? Tierney told him to do one, quite rightly. But how did he possibly think that was all right? And what was he going to find out? This is a bizarre situation we're in. Yeah. A former Premier League referee is now knocking on a former colleague's door to try and get an explanation for a mistake that he knows he made. Like, what is there to be gained from that?
Because in terms of coming back to, let's very briefly touch on that, the mistake that he made, which was giving the ball back to Liverpool when he should have given it back to Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, Forest had a corner. Forest played well, and they can feel aggrieved by it, but not too aggrieved. There were 2 minutes passed between this incident and Liverpool scoring. But they had a corner. Konaté went down with a suspected head injury, so Tierney was within his rights to stop the game. But when he did so, the ball was out with Callum Hudson-Odoi in the kind of left channel, crucially outside the penalty box, because the rule states if it's inside the penalty box, he had to drop the ball to the goalkeeper. But because it was with a Forest player, the ball should have been dropped to Forest, and so he basically gave the ball back to the wrong team. And there was a similar incident in the first half as well, which made some people even more angry about it. But he's misread the rules. He's made a mistake. But after that, Liverpool won a corner. Forest cleared it eventually. Callum Hudson-Odoi dallied on the edge of the box with it. I think he gave it to Awoniyi, who was robbed of possession. McAllister crossed it and scored. There was an opportunity. It shifted momentum. I can see why you would be upset by it. But this constant, Tony and I were discussing this before. It comes back to VAR. Everyone has got this quest for perfection that VAR has accelerated, amplified, intensified, heightened, all those things. But it can never satisfy.
Yeah.
VAR can never satisfy this quest for perfection. And Forrest now just have this sort of victimhood complex. And hiring Clattenburg is the culmination of that. They feel that they're being wronged every week. And yeah, they've had a few decisions go against them. But look, Cricky, do you remember Wolves earlier in the season?
Mm. Yeah.
How many Gary O'Neill was tearing his hair out, but Forrest they're constantly making public their complaints to the PGMOL, which, as referenced in the piece, it's almost pointless because there's always a dialogue between these people. You don't need to. It's performative. It's like heightening the pressure. Same with Clattenburg. Yeah. Clattenburg's heightening the pressure on the referees on the PGMOL. It's just again thinking whatever we can do to try and flex our muscles we're going to do. And it's pretty distasteful, I think. Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting. Just very quickly, listener David Hall emailed over the weekend saying, Paul Tierney's call was a true cock-up, but thank the Lord it was not VAR reviewable. And that was from someone looking at the game and saying that it was an error. Tony, what do you make of the Clattenburg side of things, of this role and some of the points Gregor was making?
Well, I didn't like it from initial appointment because, like most things, people think, well, all clubs have, you know, guys at set pieces, specialists, and they come in and they find new ways of setting up teams. And someone said to me, well, this is going to happen. Every team's going to have this referee come into their club. And I went, are you serious? Really? Mm. Imagine the carnage that's going to happen with referees. It's like a conflict of interest for me. And also add in, if Clattenburg goes on air, and we all know what Marianakis is like, if he said one thing that he didn't like, he'd be sacked. Mm. So he's basically a mouthpiece for the football club.
He also knows all about Marianakis because he was the head of refereeing in the Greek FA.
Yeah.
And Marianakis' club Olympiakos released a statement in 2020 publicly saying, We no longer support Clattenburg in this role. Like, he's been on the other end of it. That's he's so also, strange, I'm sure, been on the other end of, like, the criticism or, you know, if he was, he knows what it must be like to be confronted in the tunnel by his, you know, his big overbearing guy who's like, you know.
Well, I know a manager.
He must know what that's like, and yet he's acting on behalf of this man.
Well, I know two managers that have managed for him. I won't name their names, but I know two of them. And both of them said, dealing with the owner was one of the most impossible jobs ever. Mm. Now, Clattenburg is not going to do anything or say anything. I mean, to go and knock on a referee's door, being a former referee, it's like, I don't know, me as an ex-player going up to Marcus Rashford and you know, or whoever, you know, someone who's getting to, I'll use Marcus, but anybody, and then calling them out a bit or, you know.
The thing is that happens in the media.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, in whatever someone's role as a pundit or whatever, you criticise. And yet we're actually seeing, like, there's this whole kind of industry of referees now. Like, we've got one who works for the paper. You saw Mike Dean saying it was a monumental error. It wasn't a monumental error.
Yeah. It was a throw-in. It was wrong way, given the wrong way.
The one between Liverpool and Spurs. Yeah. Earlier in the season, that was a monumental error. This was a mistake that a human made, which is also a mistake, you know, like Hudson-Odoi made on edge of the box. Mistakes happen. You don't have to be happy about it, but this constant victimhood is just ridiculous.
Can I just add one little point here that and all of us to think about is that I've said to this before about players not knowing the laws of the game, which is very common. Me and Gregor would probably not know quite a number of rules.
Yeah, so many of them, aren't
there. Most of us would. But it feels a bit strange that, you know, Paul Tierney didn't actually know the rule. And I get, look, it's very complicated. There's many laws, aren't they? And they're changing it. It's like a conveyor belt.
You talk about VAR. I mean, what, could they not have said, look, you know, it should be the other way, you know, or at least kind of if he wasn't sure. But going back to Paul Tierney, you very politely said he told him to do one. And I think, you know, if I was told Clattenburg to do one, and I would, you know, I'd do that and some, because that is just terrible, isn't it? You know, referees, you know, kind of get hammered all the time, and Clattenburg will have got hammered throughout his career as a referee, and now he's you know,
on the other side,
and he's like you say, he's almost borderline agreeing with Marianakis for confronting a referee. And the other thing that I think is worrying about this is that it almost sets off like a conspiracy theory, doesn't it, really? It's like, so we've had to appoint a referee consultant because we're getting so many of these errors. So then, you know, that debate comes out and everyone says, oh, are they actually getting, you know, have they been wronged? And then do the referees look at that? Do they think of that?
If the only reason why they appointed Clattenburg was when that moment happened, to go and speak to him and say, tell us the point in law. Tell us what happened here and why it was wrong, right or wrong. If that's the only reason they hired him, you could just about stomach it. Yeah. But to use him as the public face of, like, this victimhood about officials is
digging
a bad precedent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Digging out one of his old mates, his colleagues. And that, I just him saying, I will use my connections to the PGMOL. It's like, well, Why should Nottingham Forest have that?
Yeah,
and the other 19 teams.
But the point is, as well, all the clubs have those connections. There's a constant dialogue. Tony Scholes said this last month. He was like, I don't understand why people make the complaints or any of these topics like public. We're always speaking. If you want clarification, we'll give you it.
Mm.
They do it all the time. So it's performative. Yeah, it's to exert pressure. That's what makes it really kind of distasteful.
Just very quickly on the game itself then. You said Forest played well, you know, criticising them as a club and ownership and running and things. But in terms of the football, they played well.
Yeah, they were really, really disciplined. And Liverpool were poor in the first half, and Klopp was really, really angry with a lot of things. Andy Robertson included, who got dragged in the second half. And Forest had some chances. They had one in the first half where Keller had made a really good stop on a 1v1 against Alanga. Alanga had another really good chance in the second half, kind of flashed a shot across goal, just narrowly wide. And they were in the ascendancy at the end too. So, you know, again, I do understand why you would be upset as a Forest fan about that decision, but it didn't lead directly to the goal. It's like, I think, you know, Forest obviously are in trouble too because they're possibly going to face a points deduction, and I think they're 4 or 5 points above the drop zone. So they're you know, it's going to be touch and go. But there were a lot to be positive about here. They really did frustrate Liverpool for long periods, and they could have been ahead. They could have been ahead going into those final stages beforehand.
Tony, another game, big game on Saturday, Brentford against Chelsea, your old team. Felt like the tide is slightly starting to turn against Mauricio Pochettino in terms of the Chelsea fans, this 2-2 draw.
Yeah. Oh, it's a strange one because they haven't actually had as many losses of late as what has been happening. There's been a few draws in there. I remember watching the game at Villa Park, which they won, and remember thinking 3-1 and taking on a Villa team who were a really good team and playing ever so well. But it's simmering at Chelsea all the time. And I think it's all based on a club that had so much success for two decades as finding itself a chasing club and sitting mid-table and being knocked out in the cup, and the way they were knocked out in the cup that fans are now thinking, you know, is the ex-Tottenham guy? Because let's face it, Chelsea fans don't have much time for Tottenham anyway, and anything related to Tottenham they don't particularly like. So it doesn't take a lot for it to just spill over onto the, especially at the way end of Chelsea fans, you know, singing Mourinho and not being happy with Poch. Worked on radio the weekend, number of Chelsea fans really unhappy about where the club's heading and insulting the owners, and, you know, the Bowley was getting stick, and it feels like the club has, I think Chelsea fans really believe that the days of all the glory are not coming back unless there's dramatic change. They just don't see anything really much more than, yeah, there might be a semi-final or quarter-final of a cup game or get to Wembley, but we're going to lose. And this was a club that was serial winners. So
that's the word. It's like they've gone from serial winners to like a youth project.
Yeah.
Cup team, basically.
Yeah. An experiment.
Yeah.
And there isn't feeling at the moment.
Yeah, there's very little for Chelsea fans to be happy about. I do find some of it strange, but when you spoil, you know, fans with a lot of success over a long time, fans think, you know, they're entitled to be successful again. And it's not just Chelsea fans. I think a lot of football fans, I think Man United fans feel like that. That it's just comes with the territory, and it's a club with a lot of frustration in at the moment.
Yeah, well, it was a big win for Liverpool. It was a big win for Spurs as well, and a big win for Villa, as when we mentioned Ollie Watkins. So, Hirsty, we're going to finish with your predictions, if that's all right, because I always pester these guys.
This wasn't in the script, was it?
Yeah, I know. Well, I just nearly leant across the desk and put you a note, and I thought, no, that's cheating. I don't let
even
the other
worse
guys know. Who's your title winner at this stage?
Man City.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Going to be the steamroller all the way through?
Yeah, I think it started for me when they beat Everton on, was it 28th of December? It just like seemed like the start of something then. You know, they started to, they're in that groove where, you know, they just, they'll you know, they started on a long run, and they don't even have to like hammer teams, do they?
No.
If anything, they take more pleasure in grinding out a 1-0 win or a 2-0 win, like when they beat Everton at the Etihad. You know, they can do both sides of the game, and that's what makes them so, you know, so good at this stage of the season where they can go 1-0 up and shut up shop. You know, Rodri can do those little fouls where, you know, that underrated guy, Rodri, you know, kind of the unsung hero that no one heard of. You know, do those kind of like little niggly fouls where they stop the counter-attacks. And so I just think they're in that mindset at the moment that they're just kind of on the run and nothing. They don't think anyone's going to stop them.
Presume you're happy with Liverpool and Arsenal taking up second and third place.
Yeah.
Happy with that. So who's going to get fourth? Aston Villa currently in fourth position, 27 games, 55 points. Tottenham 5 points behind, but with a game in hand. And then Manchester United quite far back now, only 11 points.
I'd probably go for Spurs. I don't know. I just quite like.
Going for Spurs? Just because you like Ange?
Well, I do, who doesn't like Ange?
Everyone loves Ange, don't they?
But I like Emery as well, to be fair. But yeah, it's I just quite like the sort of array of attacking options they've got. Son's coming back and sort of hitting form again now, so yeah.
There you go. Cheers, lad. Anyway, nice one. Thanks very much for coming on the podcast. I told you I'd be full Northern by the end of it. Paul Hurst, thank you very much for joining us. Tony Cascarino and Gregor Robertson, as usual, as well. Thank you, too, for listening. Join us again on Thursday. I won't be here, but Gregor Robertson and Martin Samuel will.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.